And tonight we're going to investigate the paranormal with Stephen Browdy. Get ready. We're going to be talking about psychokinesis and the evidence for survival of death on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Browdy is a professor and chair of philosophy at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County, editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration. The professor is the past president of the Parapsychological Association, and he has written many books. He was with me a couple of years ago as we talked about the Gold Leaf Lady and other parapsychological investigations, and here he is on Coast to Coast again. Stephen, how are you? Welcome back.
Oh, fine, thanks.
Good to have you.
Good to be here.
You've been working away, huh?
I'm sorry?
Over the last couple of years. What have you been doing?
Well, I've been chairing a philosophy department. I've been traveling a lot. And in fact, right now I'm in Serbia.
You're in Serbia. What are you doing there?
Partially family business. If you recall from when we discussed the Gold Leaf Lady, my wife is from the former Yugoslavia, and she's a virtuoso astrologer, but we come here every so often to take care of family business. And I'm also here doing some work for the Journal of Scientific Exploration. I'm trying to get the Tesla Museum in Belgrade to release some of Tesla's unpublished material.
That would be fantastic if you could pull that off.
I'm not really optimistic. They haven't been very hospitable, I'm sorry to say.
How are things in Serbia these days?
Well, let me put it this way. Let's just hope that this interview doesn't get drowned out by the sound of tractors passing by.
Okay, or snipped, too. You never know, right?
Right, exactly.
Hey, what's going on in your world of investigating the paranormal, and how in the heck did you start in that?
Well, let me explain how I started it, because it actually connects very closely with what I've been doing lately. A long time ago, when I was in graduate school, you need to understand that when I was in graduate school, I considered myself, at least at the beginning, to be a kind of hard-nosed materialist. It wasn't for any particularly good reason. It was just the kind of intellectual conceit I was cultivating in those days. And one day, it was a slow day in Northampton, Massachusetts, and most of them really were, but a couple friends came over, and we'd seen the only movie in town, and they said, let's play this game called Table Up. What they meant was, let's have a seance. They said they'd done this a few times before, and when it worked, it was a lot of fun. So for the next 3 hours, in my house, in broad daylight, I watched my table rise in the air and spell out answers in response to questions. And, you know, this really scared the hell out of me. I had no idea what was going on. I had no place in my conceptual arsenal, really, to place all of this. And, you know, there's nothing I can say. Your listeners probably don't need to be convinced, but my colleagues at the University of Massachusetts would not have been very happy about all this, and I knew I couldn't really talk to them about this.
No, they didn't want anything to hear, you know?
No, absolutely not. And there really wasn't too much I could say to them except that, you know, it was my house, it was my table, it was broad daylight. If one of my friends got up to go to the other room, the table continued to rise under the fingers of the two of us that remained, and we were standing next to the table, so there were no knees lifting the table. So I had no idea what to do with that, and I was busy writing a dissertation on temporal logic, and so I was pragmatic enough to realize that I needed to deal with this later, if at all, and so I literally put it out of mind until I got my PhD, I got a job, and I got tenure, and then having gotten tenure, I remembered that this very bizarre thing had happened to me back in grad school, and if I considered myself to be an honest intellectual and philosopher, I needed to come to grips with it. I also knew that some famous philosophers had taken parapsychological research seriously, and so I read what they had to say and decided there was really something worth sinking my teeth into here. And then I realized that if I was going to do a responsible job of this, I needed to become a member of the community of scientists and academics who were looking carefully at the evidence, so I at least could speak authoritatively about it. And I've done that, and I, you know, cranked out a bunch of books, and so the rest, as they say, is history.
Do you still feel the, I don't want to say animosity, Stephen, but just the, those who have been your friends and colleagues, do they still look at you with kind of a weary eye?
Some. I mean, it's a little bit like getting a divorce, something I've also had some experience in. Some of the people I know in the academic community whom I expected to be open-minded and very intellectually honest about all this surprised me with their closed-mindedness and their intellectual cowardice. On the other hand, some people whom I expected to be pretty rigid and unyielding about all of this surprised me with their open-mindedness. So although I still get treated pretty shabbily by a number of people in the academic community, I feel at least that I have a clearer sense of who's who, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, that's good. Now, as you got into this, did you begin to select certain areas that you wanted to investigate? Did you specialize in anything specifically?
It took me a while to figure out how I wanted to focus, and it eventually became clear that, for me at least, the most exciting and the easiest thing to do is to focus, first of all, on psychokinesis, because in principle you could document it, you could videotape it or film it. And at first I was doing some ghost investigations. I was checking out some apparent poltergeist cases. The problem is that unless you've got unlimited budget and time, that's not really a profitable way to spend your time, because a lot of times you'll go to an alleged haunting site or to a poltergeist case, and you'll just sit and wait for something to happen, and then it doesn't. And I also learned that parapsychologists are almost a surefire way to get phenomena to stop. So what I've decided to do is to go after people who at least appear to be or who claim to be psychokinetic superstars, or where phenomena are occurring for whatever reason with great regularity, so that there's a good chance of actually seeing something happen.
And you know, psychokinesis, just for those who don't know, is the ability to move things with their mind, right?
Right. Roughly, it means mind over matter. So that covers a wide variety of things. It could be object movements. It could be apparent materializations where things just seemingly come out of nowhere. It could be what's known as apports or apportation, where objects ostensibly disappear from one location and reappear somewhere else. Any of those things.
Sure. Now, as you studied this, did you come across anything, anybody that would convince you that it works?
Yeah, I've seen some pretty interesting stuff. I mean, the case that we discussed the last time I was on the show, the Gold Leaf Lady, is...
A lot of new people, so refresh everybody. That was 2 years ago. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, this is a woman in Florida whose body seems to break out in what looks like a golden foil or gold leaf. And this happens, a lot of people have seen this, very close at hand. So, for example, they might be holding her hand and suddenly the stuff just appears in large quantities on her arm. Or I was seated across from her at dinner one night and suddenly stuff started appearing on her face. And it's quite clear under these conditions that she's not manipulating anything, that she's not putting the foil on her with, you know, another hand or something like that. The stuff appears instantaneously and spontaneously.
Does it go away?
No, it doesn't go away. It hangs around. You scrape it off, and I've had it analyzed. I've collected large quantities of it. It's not gold. We have to...
if it was, we'd capture her, right? She'd be
exactly
a gold
right.
producer for us.
Now, it turns out to be brass. It's roughly 80% copper, 20% zinc. And not that that makes it any less miraculous, but... I'd say that's the most dramatic case I've seen where the phenomena are incontestably real.
Stephen, have doctors looked at her? Have they analyzed her?
Well, she's had routine medical examinations, and nothing unusual or unusually metallic has shown up in her blood work or urine or anything like
that. Strange.
And besides, I mean, this stuff occurs in large quantities, so It sometimes looks like it's coming out of her, almost as if she's sweating it. But I think she'd have to have lethal amounts of copper and zinc in her system to be producing.
Absolutely. I mean, does she look like she's been painted gold?
No. The foil, when it appears on her, it sometimes appears in layers. Remember, this is like gold leafing. It's like a very, very thin version of the wrapping around Hershey's Kisses. This stuff is 1 micron thick.
Okay, so it looked like gold cellophane, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a good way to put it, right. And so sometimes there'll just be a little flake of it. Sometimes there'll be large quantities of it. And when I say large quantities, there might be a mass of, let's say, 5 by 7 inches appearing on her. And there'll be stuff layered on top of other stuff.
And they just, like, grow out of her?
I wouldn't say it grows, it just appears. I mean, it literally appears instantaneously. And one reason I say I don't think it's coming out of her, although I have to say I haven't seen this, I've seen photos of it, I'm assured that it appears on her clothing sometimes and also in objects around the room. So her primary investigator is a psychiatrist in Florida, and he has various kinds of sealed containers, aquariums and jars and so on. And in some of these objects, there are large quantities of the foil inside them. Now, I trust this man thoroughly, and I trust Katie, the Gold Leaf Lady. So I'll take their word that she wasn't surreptitiously putting this, you know, breaking the seal and putting the stuff in the containers and then resealing it.
Does this happen at will, or just it just happens?
It just happens. She regards it as pretty much of an affliction.
So
it's
she
not
can't
entirely
control it.
Comfortable. No, she can't control it. She actually thinks it's being done to her by Nostradamus. She has a kind of fixation on Nostradamus. I think she saw a TV show at some point and got hooked on Nostradamus. And another sign of that, by the way, Katie is a good all-around psychic. She works with the police to solve crime. She seems to be a medium or a channel.
She's probably pretty good.
Yes. Well, what I was going to tell you is that when she's functionally illiterate, she's had only a first grade education, so she can't write a complete sentence.
My,
But when she's in a dissociative trance, she writes out quatrains from Nostradamus in medieval French and Latin.
That's something.
It is something.
She's channeling.
Apparently so.
Now, when this happens to her, is there any specific event that you can tie it into?
No, if only we could figure that out. I mean,
all
she
right,
may
so
go
just
through
any time, any place, huh?
Well, she seems to go through periods where it happens with great regularity, and then other periods nothing happens. It could be for months nothing happens.
Okay, what's the purpose of it though? What do you think?
Well, I have a view about that. You know about poltergeist cases?
Sure.
Well, the standard profile of a poltergeist case is that there's a disturbed or emotionally distraught teenager or adolescent, somebody with issues and no conventional way to really resolve the issues. And so the standard theory about poltergeist cases is that this teenager or adolescent can't release these pent-up feelings in a conventional, healthy way, and so it's almost as if it's a kind of brute psychic flailing about. So the teenager needs to get rid of these feelings and goes woof, and then objects shatter or fly across the room or burst into flame or whatever it might be. Now, of course, it's not just teenagers or adolescents who have emotional problems. You know, marriages are also a fertile ground for emotional distress. So Katie's marriage to her second husband, current husband, is, as far as I can tell, also problematical, and none of her psychic abilities emerged until she married this guy. And there was a point at which poltergeist-like things were happening to her. So objects were moving around the house, rearranging themselves and so on, and appearing and disappearing. And one day, a carving set appeared out of nowhere, and Katie's husband said to her, "What good is it if it isn't money?" And then 2 days later, Katie's body started to break out in what looks like gold leaf. So if you want my pop psychological analysis of this, it would be that symbolically this allows Katie to satisfy her husband's demand for something valuable, but she doesn't really have to bear the responsibility of being the goose that laid the golden egg.
That's right. Well, then maybe she's the one who's helped conjuring this up.
That's what I'm thinking. And I'll tell you also, I think it's a way in which she gets to express her generally suppressed rage against her husband, because she's not really giving him what he wants. It's fool's gold. You know, it's like giving him the psychic finger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like getting candy that is not really candy.
Yeah.
Of course, I haven't had candy in a long time, Stephen. You have looked into studies of mediums. Tell me about your interest here. And how many of them do you think are frauds? You know, Houdini went looking for them, too, and he didn't find any.
Well, as far as I know, that's a complex story, but I'm not enough of an authority on that to want to go any further with that. But let's be clear about one thing. There are two kinds of mediums. There are mental mediums that seem to channel communications from the deceased. And then there are the kinds of mediums that I've actually spent more time with, and these are the physical mediums around whom apparently psychokinetic things happen, like tables levitate and objects materialize or dematerialize. And in the early days of the spiritualist movement, or in the heyday of spiritualism, which was from the mid-19th century to the early part of the 20th century, a lot of people looked at these physical phenomena as another way in which departed spirits could express their continued existence after death, because sometimes tables would tilt out messages. They'd spell out answers in response to codes, or they'd give yes or no answers, and by nodding once for yes, twice for no, or something like that. So I don't know how many, certainly a lot of them have been frauds. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, mediumship is an invitation for gullible people and unscrupulous other people to get into the act. There's no doubt about that. I don't know what the proportion is. I have no doubt, however, that there are some genuine cases of both kinds, mental mediums and physical.
Sure,
mediums.
And those are the ones I want to concentrate on for a little bit, Stephen, with you.
Those are the cases that matter, because, you know, what bothers me is when skeptics try to dismiss the entire body of mediumistic evidence by pointing to the weak cases. Of course there are weak cases, but they're irrelevant in this discussion. I mean, what we want to analyze are those cases that are hardest to explain away. Those are the ones that count.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit more about these physical mediumships and the phenomena behind that.
Well, so this was connected to the thing that happened to me back in grad school, uh-huh. where I saw this table rise. And in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there were some truly spectacular cases that sort of set the stage for some of the things that we're seeing today and which I've recently investigated. So, for example, one of the best cases of all time was a late 19th century medium, Daniel Douglas Hume, H-O-M-E. And Hume's case is important because his case lasted for roughly 25 years. He was never caught cheating. I mean, people claimed that he cheated, but all those claims were second or third hand.
They could never find out, could they?
No. But what's really interesting about the case of Hume is that he would conduct seances at the spur of the moment in locations he'd never visited before. So you can't attribute the phenomena to his having concealed an apparatus or planted a Confederate.
Exactly. Set the stage or anything like that.
Exactly right. And the phenomena were incredibly large scale. And he also had an amazingly large repertoire of phenomena. So there are lots of accounts, for example, of Hume walking into a room that he'd never visited before, and the bookshelf across the room starts walking toward the company. And he also, well, let me just mention a couple of his phenomena. So, for example, an accordion allegedly would play either untouched, floating around the room, or held at the end of the way, at the end away from the keys. And people would say the accordion would play melodies on request.
And witnesses would actually see this.
Yes. Actually, let me pause on that one for a minute, because one of the best documented and I think most important cases in the history of physical mediumship has to do with Hume's accordion phenomenon.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back. Stephen, we're going to take this quick break, and we will be right back. You are live in Serbia, and we are live out of Los Angeles. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed it is. If you're not a Streamlink member yet, well, you can be by going to coasttocoastam.com to sign up for it, and you would get your podcasting and your past archives, listen to the program in areas that you might not be able to hear your radio, and have some fun doing that. If you have an iPhone, you have apps there, and we're working on the Android and BlackBerry apps now. Got a meeting on it tomorrow, as a matter of fact. Back in a moment with Stephen Browdy as we talk about his work on the paranormal side on Coast to Coast AM. What's so fascinating about your work too, Stephen, is it's so wide-ranging. You've covered many areas of the supernatural and the paranormal. Now let's get into the floating organ again. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is D.D. Hume's accordion phenomenon, and one of his principal investigators was the famous chemist and physicist William Crookes. And an important piece of background information on this case is that Hume thought that the power that he was summoning as a medium was strongest under the seance table. Now, I understand, and so did Crookes, that superficially this can sound very suspicious. It can sound like it's a ploy for some sort of legerdemain or trickery. And Crookes also realized that this might also just be a genuine belief that Hume had about the way the phenomena worked. And so he realized that if he was to be a good experimenter here, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to force Hume out of his comfort zone. If Hume really genuinely believed that the phenomena were strongest under the seance table, then his responsibility as experimenter was to find a way to test the phenomena under the seance table. So here's what he did. And I think this is one of the most important experiments in the history of parapsychology. First of all, he bought a new accordion for the accordion.
The sound good, right?
Yeah. Well, not only that, we didn't want people to say, well, this could have been one of Hume's props that he had rigged in advance.
Sure. Good point.
So he bought a new accordion. Then he went over to Hume's apartment to pick him up. He watched him change clothes so he could make sure that he wasn't hiding some kind of device on his body that would have allowed him to do this. Although, keep in mind, this was 1871. It's not clear what kind of device Hume could have concealed that would make accordions play melodies on request. And then he brought Hume back to his house, where he had built a cage made out of wire and wood that fit just underneath his dining room table. There was room for Hume to get his hand into the cage under the tabletop, so he could hold the accordion at the end away from the keys. There was not enough room for Hume to get his hand all the way into the cage so he could actually manipulate the accordion. Now, there were 9 observers present, one stationed on either side of Hume to make sure that he wasn't taking his feet out of his boots. And there was another observer stationed under the table with a lamp. And under those conditions, the accordion was seen to move around inside the cage. It moved in and out. The keys were depressed. Sounds came out of the accordion. Then Crookes asked Hume to take his hand out of the cage, put both hands on the table. He ran an electric current through the cage, and the accordion in the cage continued to flop around. Now, there's not a magician alive who's ever tried to duplicate that phenomenon under anything like the conditions in which Hume succeeded. And I think for good reason, they can't do it.
They have no idea.
Not a clue.
This area of investigating seances, for example, we talked a little bit about the witnesses before the break. How important are they and how reliable can they be? Aren't some of them, most of them, under stress? They're anxious. They want to communicate. Are they reliable?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think, again, the cases that matter are the cases where that's not a legitimate concern. I think a real concern of some people is that the witnesses, as you note, are going to be biased in favor of the phenomena. They might be looking for something miraculous or looking for something in particular. But in lots of cases, the witnesses are neutral with respect to the phenomena. Sometimes they're skeptical about the phenomena. And some of the strongest cases have to do with mediums who were investigated by magicians or other potential debunkers who were there actually to prove that the mediums were fraudulent and came away believing that the mediums were genuine. So another famous case in the history of spiritualism or spiritism is the case of Eusebia Palladino. This was a peasant woman from Naples who also had a large repertoire of phenomena. Ironically, but in a way, interestingly, she would cheat. She admitted that she would cheat if given the chance. And that was reason enough for a lot of investigators to just write her off right from the beginning. But others realized that some of her phenomena apparently were being produced under conditions that were impeccable. And there's a long story here. I'll cut to the chase. Sure. She was eventually, the British Society for Psychical Research, under pressure from researchers in other parts of Europe, sent what they considered to be their fraud squad to Naples in 1908 to investigate Eusebia, and actually to go there for the purpose of showing that she was absolutely a fraud.
And were these people good without technological, you know, the technology we've got today?
Well, I mean, that's a double-edged sword. You know, there may not have been the means that we have now for detecting fraud, but there also wasn't means there for producing fraud,
right,
especially the large-scale, interesting stuff produced under the best of conditions.
Sure.
So the three investigators the society sent to Naples, all three of them were experts at debunking fraudulent mediums. They had each of them had probably exposed 100 mediums or more.
And I bet they went into it wanting to do that.
Absolutely. That was the reason they were going.
Okay.
And one of them was a working magician, another was a good amateur magician, and the other just knew all the tricks of the trade. He even wrote a book on the methods of fraudulent mediumship. And they conducted 11 seances with Eusebia in decent electric light. They got almost 500 phenomena that they documented. Oh, and I should tell you that the way they did this was they had a stenographer present. This was a standard technique that the investigators were using with Eusebia. You know, they didn't have video cameras, so they needed some blow-by-blow way of documenting what was going on. So the stenographer sat in one corner of the room, and the investigators would call out how they were controlling the medium and what was happening. So one investigator might say, I'm holding Eusebia's left hand and left foot. Another would say, I'm holding Eusebia's right hand and right foot. And another would say, I'm sitting on Eusebia's lap. And then they would say, table levitation. And the stenographer would write down all the stuff as it was happening. So you could read back the transcripts of these 11 seances and really get, it's kind of boring after a while, but get a blow-by-blow description. What's even more interesting than that, and this gets to your point about the biases of the witnesses, after each seance, the investigators would write down their own reactions about what was happening. And you can read as the seances progress from one to the next how their resistance to the phenomena begins to crumble. And they're fighting against
themselves.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
And so you can't claim in cases like this that the witnesses were unprepared. They didn't know. I mean, they knew exactly what Eusebia's repertoire of phenomena were. They knew the tricks of the trade. They knew how phenomena like Eusebia's or some of them might be produced fraudulently. They were not taken by surprise. They had ample opportunity to examine the phenomena while they were occurring. You can't write off the testimony to the fallibility of memory because the stenographer was writing it all down. So it's a great case of Eusebia Paladino.
What conclusions have you come to about what might be on the other side?
Boy, I wish I could answer that. I mean, I wrote a whole book on the evidence for life after death to try to work that out for myself. I mean, that's why I write books, to figure out what my views are.
Yeah, they're your own puzzling questions.
Well, yeah, and until I actually work through it myself, I'm usually not comfortable making confident pronouncements about things like this. But when I examined the evidence for life after death, what I came away with more than anything else was an enhanced appreciation of just how remarkable living human beings are. Because one of the things I began to understand is that we really don't know anything really about the limits and the nature of human abilities. When you start looking at prodigies, when you start looking at what used to be called idiot savants, now we just call them savants,
You
realize that there are lots of remarkable things that people can do without practice, sometimes things that are apparently incompatible with their other deficits or their other abilities. So savants, for example, you could have a musical savant who's spastic until he sits down to play the piano. There are calculating savants who can factor any number you give to them, but who can't add the change in their pocket. And this is important because you look at some cases suggesting survival of bodily death, and you see people who are apparently speaking a language or little bits of a language that they never studied. But it's not as if we really understand language use or the limits of human creativity. We do know that in various kinds of altered states, like some dissociative states, people sometimes dramatically exceed their everyday waking capacities. And I don't think we really know just how far those kinds of things can go.
Do they make,
that make sense?
Yeah, but do they make people, Stephen, more comfortable when people have a belief system that life continues in some form or fashion?
Yes.
What do you think it does for them personally? I mean, I know for me, it's kind of a neat feeling. I mean, just
Absolutely.
To think that it just, that's it. It's over. You know, you close your eyes, you die, and it's done. That's kind of depressing.
It's absolutely depressing. So there's no question that a belief in an afterlife can be extremely comforting unless, well, depending on your view of what the afterlife is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But you're right. It certainly can be very comforting, and it doesn't leave you with this kind of existential angst about the meaning of it all and the futility of living and that kind of thing. So, sure, that's... It can be a very valuable and comforting belief to have, but a lot of people will say that's exactly the reason why we shouldn't take it seriously, that the belief in life after death really just is an expression of our need to feel that life has meaning.
Is it accurate to say that because so many people have witnessed very strange apparitions in their realm, visitations from their dearly departed, I mean, these things have happened to people. Whether they're making them up or not, they're happening to these people. These people believe it.
Yes.
Do we have enough data out there to say it's overwhelming that there's something real and something bizarre going on? Can we say that?
We can absolutely say that. But for me, the tricky question is whether the weird thing that's happening is evidence of survival of bodily death, or whether the main contender for me is whether it's evidence of a very kind of subtle psychic functioning among the living, which simulates the evidence for survival of bodily death. See, look, I mean, if you're asking what's basically a scientific question, do we have evidence that people survive, or some people at least, survive the death and decomposition of their bodies? What we are looking for is, first of all, that some living person shows knowledge associated with the deceased person or abilities associated with the deceased person. And we need to know that this knowledge or the abilities weren't obtained by normal means.
True.
Okay?
True.
So, consider what happens in a mediumistic case, all right? Let's suppose that a medium says to me, Uncle Harry knows Uncle Harry's communicating with me now, and he knows you're eager to quit your job.
And let's say that's true.
Yes. So the question is, how does the medium know what Uncle Harry's thinking?
And how does the medium even know who Uncle Harry is?
Right. But here's the tricky part. If there's communication going on between the medium and Uncle Harry, that's telepathy. All right?
All right.
So if you believe in evidence for survival, evidence that can be expressed in a mediumistic context, you're already supposing that there's a kind of telepathy between the deceased and the living.
Right.
So if already you're positing the existence of telepathy. So that opens the door for saying that what we could have instead is just telepathy between the medium and the person who's eager to quit his or her job.
That's so very possible, isn't it?
That's right. Right. So whether you're a believer in the actuality of mediumship or communication with the deceased, or whether you're just a believer in psychic functioning, you have to posit psychic functioning no matter what. It's telepathy no matter what.
Okay.
Or if Uncle Harry says, I like the tie you're wearing, how does Uncle Harry know what you're wearing? Uncle Harry doesn't have a body. That's clairvoyance. So if you believe in mediumistic communication, you're already positing the existence of psychic functioning. But if you're positing the existence of psychic functioning, it could just as well be between the living.
Well, that's true. But even if it's just between the living, That alone tells you that there's something very unusual out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's psychic functioning no matter what.
Yes.
And yeah, so that's for me the bottom line. And the real tough question to answer is whether there's any conclusive reason for saying it's survival psychic functioning or living agent psychic functioning.
See, I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I have a hard time settling that one for myself.
You know, my belief system is that whatever this was when it started and whatever it is when it ends for an individual, that it's all the same. I think that these entities go in the same region of the ether, wherever it may be, whatever it might be, as they came in and as they go out. The soul, which is, I think, in existence before the physical realm, it's there, it's out there, it's always been there, and it's just a process. It's a natural process. I had a show last night about the Human Genome Project, and I've got to tell you, this body that we have is so complicated and works so well, it defies logic as far as I'm concerned. There's just so many things, millions and billions of cells that just work and, you know, in tandem with each other, that just to roll the dice and say, it all just happened, I can't comprehend that.
I understand.
It makes no sense to me that this has all been by accident. Something is out there. You know, folks who are religious will say it's God. People who are spiritual won't necessarily say God, but they believe in the same thing. We're just calling it different things.
Sure.
But there's something out there. And I think the belief in the afterlife is just an extension of it. And it's probably not as unusual as we think.
I'm sure that's true. And I'll tell you, this is one of the ways in which the kind of scientific questions about the evidence of survival have their limitations, because it's approaching the whole question of survival from a certain point of view. And frankly, I'm in a kind of schizophrenic place about it, because in my heart of hearts, I certainly would like to believe in the reality of survival for the reasons we just talked about. And I appreciate the impact of many of the case studies that have been carefully examined. I appreciate the kind of testimony that people give that certainly suggests the reality of the afterlife. I take people seriously. I know these are not crazy people who are saying these things. And on the other hand, if you try to approach this purely objectively, it's hard to get the kind of answer you're looking for. So you have to decide which of these stances you're going to take. Are you going to take the one that's based more in your instinct, or are you going to take the one that's based more in pure rationality? I don't think one necessarily trumps the other.
You know, as you know, Stephen, we have millions of listeners to this program every night, millions of listeners. And when you stop and think about this for just one second, that eventually every listener to this program is going to die one day.
Yes.
Every listener. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And as you get older, you begin to think about that even more. So let's talk about that, because somewhere along the line, you have the key to the other side. And I want you to kind of unlock the door. We'll be right back.